Europe is experiencing the largest wave of refugees since World War II and is desperate to find a long-term solution. Join America Abroad for a town hall discussion linking New York to Berlin on iTunes and PRI.org/America Abroad.
From combat to stand-up, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Isaura Ramirez served as an army captain in Iraq. She came home and battled depression. And now she's fighting that with stand-up comedy.
What comedy does, you know, if I book a gig, I better be in a good mood to get up there and go on stage and do it. And, you know, you have to force yourself to get out of bed. You have to force yourself to go out there and be with people.
Plus, the president's top science advisor gets ready for the upcoming global climate talks in Paris.
We need to take action to reduce the amount of climate change we're going to have to cope with. We need to cooperate on building preparedness and resilience to deal with the changes in climate that can no longer be avoided.
Those stories, plus the environmental dangers of Diwali, today on The World.
The World is brought to you by Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. It's Veterans Day, of course, and we decided to let veterans decide what stories we open with today. So we reached out to our online community of veterans and asked them for their suggestions. By the way, if you're a veteran, you can be part of that community too. Just text the word RETURN to 69866. For this Veterans Day, we heard back from a lot of folks, and here are a few things they wanted to hear about. One is an update on the problems that have plagued the Department of Veterans Affairs lately. And second, a success story about one of their own. So coming up, we'll hear from a retired Army captain who now does stand-up comedy inspired by her years of service. First, though, to the VA and its problems. Last year, we learned about the unreal appointment scheduling backlog of VA patients. And as a result, the agency's top management was rewired. So how's that going? Ben Kessling's been covering that story for the Wall Street Journal. He's also a former Marine infantry officer. I asked Kessling to start by telling us how the VA's new boss is doing.
Bob McDonald came in last year as a former CEO of Procter & Gamble, brought a lot of business acumen to the job, and came in with a lot of goodwill from Congress, from the administration, and from veterans groups. And since then, it's taken a while to turn the big ship that is the VA, a budget of more than $160 billion in 2015, second largest department in the U.S. government. But Mr. McDonald has been making changes. He's been implementing things, but if you even ask the man himself, he says that there's still plenty to be done and it's going to take a long time to make long-term systemic changes at the department.
Is McDonald himself a vet?
He is. He is a West Point graduate. He is an airborne Army veteran himself.
So what kind of impact do you think he's had on the culture? Because a lot of people were saying that a lot of this is about the culture at the VA, that things really need to be kind of dug into at the foundation.
Well, one thing that Mr. McDonald has launched almost from the beginning of his tenure there at the VA is something called the My VA program, which is he wants to make the patient the center of the VA's focus. So he wants to make sure that it's not a focus on the system itself or purely on cost. He wants to make sure that all employees are looking to do customer service first. Mm. And he wants to just speed the availability of appointments and making sure that veterans are being taken care of and not swallowed up in the system, which was one of the big issues that hit the VA last summer with the wait time scandal that originated in Phoenix.
Are those wait times getting any better?
They are getting better, but there's still issues that are being pointed out. So the Department of Veterans Affairs has an inspector general that issues reports, and they come out about a couple times every week, and they're looking at things like wait times and whether or not the Veterans Choice Act has been having an effect on veterans being able to get seen by doctors. I mean, the Veterans Choice Act was something passed by Congress right after Mr. McDonald took his position, and more than $16 billion emergency funding bill to essentially hire more doctors and to provide for out-of-network or out-of-VA care for people who are either more than 40 miles away from a VA facility or have to wait more than 30 days for an appointment. People have been getting appointments through that. Wait times have been going down, but there's still problems with that rollout. I was just talking to a veteran the other day who hasn't received the VA Choice Card, as it's called, in the mail, which was supposed to be sent to all veterans so they could take advantage of getting care outside the VA if wait times are too long.
I mean, there are lots of veterans who have nothing but praise for the VA. If you were to do a straw poll of your old buddies, what kind of grade do you think they'd give the VA today?
Well, when veterans are polled about the quality of care, those who are in the system, those who are taking advantage of VA care, they say that they would rather have care there than anywhere else. But there are veterans who, and this is part of the wait time scandal of last year, goes back to veterans trying to get that first appointment. That's what was taking so long, and that's what a lot of the delays come from. That's one of the main complaints that veterans have.
Ben Kessling of the Wall Street Journal and a former Marine, thank you very much for speaking with us, and thank you for your service.
Thank you, Marco.
One ailment we know that's sadly common among combat veterans is depression, and coping with it is a big and often wrenching challenge. Retired Army Captain Isaura Ramirez tried therapy first. Now she does a stand-up routine inspired by her 13 years in uniform.
We use last names in the Army, so I would be, you know, I'm Captain Ramirez. And people would be like, oh, you mean Ramirez? I'm like, no, I mean Ramirez. I'm pretty sure I am pronouncing it correctly.
So last year you retired from the Army after 13 years. You spent 15 months in Iraq. What was that like?
It was a long sentence. You know, I was a transportation officer, and I barely know how to change a tire. So I was a first lieutenant when I deployed. I promoted there to a captain. And, you know, I had to put together this entire training plan. And then here I am. I'm 5'3". I was like 120 pounds. And they're looking at me like, okay, little captain, what are you going to teach us? Because this was an Iraqi colonel.
Did you ever tell them, you know, maybe I'm not the best person for this job?
No, you know, I have learned early on that you fake it until you make it. And you know, I had very knowledgeable sergeants working with me.
So how did you go after retiring from the military? How'd you get into stand-up comedy?
I got a medical retirement from the military, and I opened a business, and that did not go as planned. It was very stressful. And then my husband just happened to go into a coffee shop and saw a flyer for free comedy classes for veterans. And he signed me up. Just kind of took off after that.
So where have you taken your comedy today? What do you talk about?
Most of my material, I would say, is kind of my point of view of being a Hispanic female in the Army and here in the States, you know, my perspective as a Latino, because I was born in Puerto Rico. And, you know, a lot of people don't realize, you know, it is a U.S. territory and we are born U.S. citizens.
Are there things in your comedy that you talk about, like things that you really miss about the Army?
I miss, like, being in uniform. I remember just walking around and everybody comes up to you and say, thank you. And it's awkward because you're like, I don't know what to say. I was at a store and then this mom came up to me and she had a daughter about 5 years old. Mm. And she said, my daughter wanted to come over and thank you for your service. And I was like, oh my God, that's so cute. Wow. I'm like, do you want to be a soldier when you grow up? And she said, no, I don't want to get killed. That's smart. I wish I would have thought of that before I signed up.
You think now if you go back, if it was possible, you wouldn't reenlist?
I would. You know, I have learned so much. It was hard. It was a struggle sometimes, but I wouldn't be the person I am today if I hadn't been through that.
I know you struggle with depression. Was that triggered by your military service?
I think so. I really noticed my symptoms getting worse after I came back from deployment. And again, I am a female Hispanic officer. There was no one there that looked like me, that I could hang out with, that I could relate to. So I pretty much spent 15 months by myself. You know, I did my job. People are like, you do comedy. Like, you must be like, you know, you love being around people. I'm like, well, I forced myself to do it because that was the kind of person I was before I joined the military. And I just turned into this very secluded person that just wants to be by herself.
I've heard from other veterans that as tough as it may be to talk about what they've been through and some of the traumas they've experienced, talk therapy, telling someone what happened actually does work. And I'm just wondering, is stand-up comedy that talk therapy for you in addition to anything else you might have done?
Absolutely. You know, I went a lot of years not knowing that I was depressed. my husband was like, there's something wrong with you. You need to go see a therapist. And that helped. But you see, the therapy just made me realize that I had a problem. I needed to work on it. But I was very angry. I have a lot of anger for things that had happened to me throughout the year. So this comedy, a lot of my bits are based on those thoughts. And now when something bad happens to me now, I'm like, okay, this is going to be great material.
Well, it's really great to hear how comedy has helped you. How are you doing today?
Depression is not something that gets cured. I don't think. You know, you just manage it and you fake it until you make it. And that's really how you manage your depression. You have to force yourself to get out of bed. You have to force yourself to go out there and be with people. And being in this environment really helps me get out of the house and just be the person that I used to be.
Army combat veteran and stand-up comic Isaura Ramirez. He's performed with the College of William & Mary, Center for Veterans Engagement, and the Armed Services Arts Partnership. It was really great to meet you, Isaura. Thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
There was a lot of talk about taxes last night at the GOP candidates' debate, but nobody mentioned those big corporations that pay fewer taxes by setting up their headquarters somewhere else, somewhere offshore, perhaps. In Wales, some business owners in a tiny village called Crickowl figure they can do that too with a little help from a TV company that's making a film about them. These guys run the local coffee shop, a camping store, and the bookstore, among others, and they've declared their town to be offshore, setting up their tax affairs in the same way that some multinationals do. Jeff Thomas owns Crickowl's camping store, Crickowl Adventure. You know, you may be tax-free and offshore, but I doubt it's ever going to look like the Cayman Islands, Jeff.
Well, probably not. But nevertheless, it's been a very interesting journey. And it doesn't seem as difficult to do as we were originally told before we started our little venture and expedition to various places to find out exactly how the systems work.
So for those of us who've never been to Crickowl, paint a picture for us. What's it look like?
It's a nice little Georgian town of 2,500 inhabitants, as I said. It nestles between in the Esk Valley at the foot of the Black Mountains. It has nice pubs, nice shops, friendly people. It's just a really nice place.
Yeah, so tell us why the shops in Crickowl decided to do this.
Well, Crickowl consists almost entirely of independent businesses, with the exception of a Boots store, which, of course, don't pay any tax. Now, they're owned by an American company.
That's like CVS. It's a pharmacy, right?
Yeah, quite, exactly. And we were approached by some documentary filmmakers because of the independent nature of our town and asked, would we like to participate in this examination of what the large corporations do in order to avoid excessive taxation?
Is this being driven by the TV producers? I mean, are you
it isn't really driven. It's sort of, there was some steering initially, but because we found out so much about it and it's made us so mad that it's now sort of going to be self-propagating.
I mean, it's kind of admirable what you're doing, but can you imagine what would happen like if every town in the UK decided to follow suit and said we're all offshore? I mean, wouldn't tax revenue for the entire United Kingdom just go right down the tubes and like
that is
real
the
fast?
Entire point. Most of the United Kingdom's tax burden is borne by small and medium-sized businesses. Large companies basically pay a very, very small contribution towards the total tax take of this country because they are so skilled at setting up the systems to avoid paying the tax. And the whole purpose of this exercise is so that the government will take another look at the tax laws and change the system, close some loopholes, and we'll have more large companies paying a sensible amount of corporation tax.
What's been the reaction from your customers?
It's good. You've only got to look at Twitter and Facebook. There's tens and tens and tens of support from everywhere.
Tens and tens. I mean, but that's a town of 2,500 people, so you're not going to probably get more than that, will you?
No, but I mean outside the town.
And it sounds like you there in Crickowl, you're determined and going to go through with this.
Yeah, I think it's time. Many people in this country aren't very well off. There isn't enough support for them. And it's about time people started paying their fair share of the tax.
Jeff Thomas with Crickowl Adventure in Crickowl, Wales. Thanks very much.
Okay, no problem. Bye-bye.
How a former cab driver in China ended up with the world's second most expensive painting. That's next on The World.
Support for The World comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 17,000 skills like decluttering, drone photography, and duct tape crafting. Curious.com. Grow your skills. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. You may have heard about the sale of Modigliani's Reclining Nude this week, second highest price ever paid at auction for a painting, north of $170 million. The new proud owner, a Chinese billionaire who got his start as a taxicab driver, he plans to display the painting at one of his art museums in Shanghai. Isaac Stonefish writes a lot about China at Foreign Policy magazine. So Isaac, the man who bought this Modigliani, Liu Yichen, who is he? One of China's many overnight billionaires?
He made his first big pot of money by buying low and selling high on a stock trade. Liu actually likes to use the expression, when it's stocks, buy low, and when it's art, buy high. And I feel like a lot of the art he's bought has also been part of a business strategy that's very eccentric, but also has helped him make a lot of money and stay in the good graces of the party in Shanghai.
Does he qualify as kind of one of China's nouveau riche?
He's a poster boy. He best fits that description for his behavior in April 2014, when he spent $36.3 million buying an extremely rare 500-year-old Ming Dynasty cup decorated with chickens on it, and subsequently was photographed drinking tea out of that cup. For many people in China, there was nothing so gauche and nothing so nouveau riche than to drink out of the cup that the emperor used, a $36.3 million antique.
Yeah, wow. Mr. Liu and his wife go big on art. They're not just collectors. They're also the money behind at least two museums, right? So it sounds like they're patrons now.
They very much are. They have two big and very, very nice museums in a very Tony neighborhood in Shanghai. I think what they're trying to do is they're trying to show that a lot of this art, some of which is very valuable Chinese art and which has spent a lot of times overseas, is now returned to China in its rightful place.
Now, this Modigliani that Mr. Liu purchased is going to hang at the Long Museum in Pudong. And a spokesperson there was talking about this very sensuous nude image in the painting and what museum goers in China are going to tolerate. And they said the public does not live in the 70s and 80s. It's the 21st century now. Fair enough, but is the Chinese central government as open-minded?
I think they're very open-minded to something like that. I think if it were a picture of Mao Zedong laying there nude while corpses laid under him, they might be a little more reserved. But I think for something like this kind of openness is something that the Chinese government generally doesn't worry too much about.
I mean, $170 million sets the bar pretty high. Can we expect to see more Chinese art patrons trying to make a name for themselves?
I mean, I think Liu has made it much more difficult for other Chinese billionaires to get a lot of free publicity for buying really expensive art. You know, if someone's spending $170 million on a painting like this, the New York Times and dozens of other media outlets are not going to cover someone who just buys a painting for $120 million. So I think if there is still a lot of excess capital floating around, you know, we might see other buys like this. He's certainly not making it easy.
Isaac Stonefish, Asia editor at Foreign Policy. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco.
The very rich in China never had any economic issues with having only one child. When China recently changed its one-child policy to a two-child policy, it was good news for all families yearning for another kid. But what about the families that already had babies in secret? Rebecca Cantha reports from Shanghai.
4 months ago, my Chinese husband and I gave birth to our second child, a sweet baby boy. When I walk with him outside, holding onto my three-year-old daughter's hand, the neighborhood aunties run over. They make a fuss over my kids and remind me I'm the luckiest of moms. Because I'm a foreigner here, my husband and I didn't even think about the one-child policy when we decided to have another child. When I saw the news that China was finally changing the rules to allow all couples to have two children, I immediately called up my friend Xiaoge. She lives in a small city in central Henan province. Just 5 weeks before the announcement, she gave birth to her second child, in secret. I visited her when her son was just a month old. She spoke softly, cautious about telling her story. We wanted our daughter to have a playmate, someone to help her if she has problems. And also, our families put pressure on us. They're traditional, and they think having one child is not enough. Xiaoge and her husband tried for years to have another child. And finally, this year she got pregnant. But she and her husband work for a public university. And in China, people with government jobs face more scrutiny. Xiaoge knew that if her employer found out she was pregnant, she and her husband would both lose their jobs. My friend's not a rule breaker. She doesn't take risks. But she wanted a baby. So, early in her pregnancy, before she began to show, she went to her supervisor and asked for sick leave. Then she stayed at home for the remainder of her pregnancy, rarely leaving the house. Still, it was easier than it would have been just 10 years ago, she says. Back then, you'd have to get approval to have a child before you went to the hospital. Nowadays, hospitals don't care. We got a birth certificate. What they didn't get was a hukou, that all-important document that's like a residence card or a passport. A hukou gets you access to health care, schooling, and other public services in China. I have another Chinese friend who ran into a similar problem. Christina lives in Shanghai, and 3 years ago she gave birth to her second child. We talked about it outside of Starbucks. In the first few months, I went back and forth about whether to have the child. There was so much pressure, she says. She too worked at a public university and risked losing her job. But she decided to quit. Her parents were very upset. They couldn't understand at all why I wanted to give up my job to have another child. My father was still yelling at me even when I was 6 or 7 months pregnant. Christina knew that in order to get her daughter a hukou, she'd have to pay a fine. But she was shocked when she found out how much. $37,000.
The lowest price.
That was 2 to 3 times what she and her husband earned in a year. So she dropped the idea. Back then, Christina felt depressed. But today, her children are 4 and 3, and she seems much happier. A few months ago, she went to the police to try again to get a hukou for her daughter so she could go to nursery school. This time she got it, and surprisingly, she didn't have to pay the fine. As for Xiaoge, she's stuck in limbo, since the policy change won't go into effect until probably next year. She lives in a part of the country that's stricter about the family planning policy. She and her husband will try to buy a fake birth certificate so they can change their baby's date of birth. They've even talked about getting a divorce so that her husband won't lose his job if they're found out. Yet she says she feels hopeful. I think we will just put off the hukou. We'll just wait and see, she says. What was surprising to me was that for most other couples, the change in policy might not mean much of anything at all. When I asked one friend whether she was planning a second child, she replied, "Tai mafan. It's just too much of a hassle." None of Christina's friends have 2 children. She says they're always like, "Ah, wow, you're so great. I'm so envious you have 2 kids. But when Christina says, "You can have 2 kids too."
"Oh, no, no, no.
I don't want more," they say. "One is enough." Still, the news has tired moms talking as they consider how the policy change might affect their lives. In one mom's group, the joke is, "As long as the government doesn't say we have to have a second child." For The World, I'm Rebecca Canther in Shanghai.
Still ahead, there's some good news for the climate when you look at the evolution of subway maps around the globe. You're tuned to The World. I'm Marco Werman. Hindus across India celebrate Diwali. Many do it with fireworks, lots and lots of fireworks, which means lots and lots of smoke.
Just letting everybody who can buy firecrackers indiscriminately set them off, I mean, it's going to harm your kids.
Diwali's impact on air quality in India. That story's ahead on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI and Soundworks.org, a collection of podcasts from PRI with global voices and perspectives, including Whose Century Is It? From The World's Mary Kay Magstad. Explore and subscribe at Soundworks.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. We're going to set our sights on the environment for the next few minutes. Coming up, President Obama's science advisor tells me he's actually hopeful about what we can do to meet the challenges of climate change. We'll also hear some encouraging news about mass transit. But first, happy Diwali. Today, Hindus across the globe celebrate a new year. Bear with me. This is about the environment, too. They clean their houses, exchange gifts, and light decorative lamps, but with all the Diwali celebrations comes a downside: air pollution, really bad air pollution in some parts of India. Nimisha Jaiswal has reported about this for our partners at Global Post, and she joins me now from New Delhi. Nimisha, welcome to us, and happy Diwali.
Thank you. Same to you, Marco.
So explain to us how Diwali affects the environment.
Well, the festival itself focuses on families getting together and lighting earthen lamps across the house, as you mentioned. But a big part of the celebration is setting off firecrackers. Now, these are in 40 different categories being produced in little towns all over India. And these firecrackers have no controls on their composition, and they directly set off the levels of nitrogen dioxide, carbon dioxide, and particulate matter, which is all basically really bad for your lungs.
I mean, when I set off firecrackers as a kid, one firecracker wouldn't produce a lot of smoke, so they must be setting off tons of fireworks.
Right, because we are a country of 1.2 billion people. 80% of us, at least, are Hindus. And the celebration is so wide that I'm sure that people from other religions participating as well. Now imagine each of these families setting off anywhere between 20 to 100 firecrackers. It becomes a status symbol almost, because the more firecrackers you set off, the more excited you are about Diwali. Gotcha. And this has no time limit, and there's a 20-day lead up to this festival. So the firecrackers actually start going off at least a week before.
Wow, so you're talking a month of firecrackers.
Easily. Of course, this becomes the most intense on the night of Diwali itself, but there are definitely firecrackers going off for 20 days before the festival.
So who's actually done the research into like the connection between lung infections and Diwali? I mean, have there been cases of lung infections in individuals as a result of this festival?
So I wouldn't call it lung infections as much as an aggravation of respiratory system symptoms in people with an ongoing problem. So people with asthma, people with bronchitis. The air in Delhi is anyway about 2 to 3 times worse than the acceptable standard. Over Diwali, it becomes 10 times as bad. So people are suffering, children are suffering, and because a child's lungs are developing, any excessive exposure to pollution is terrible for them.
It might have been too faint for our listeners, but did I just hear some kind of explosion behind you? Was that a fireworks?
Yes, they're still going on. It's 12:26 in India. The Indian Supreme Court has mandated that firecrackers cannot be set off between 10 p.m. and 6 a.m., but these rules are not followed at all. If you'd called me 45 minutes ago, you would have heard a lot more.
Wow. Okay, so that's just an 8-hour window. What is being done about this?
So, Marco, this should have been addressed years ago. But India has only started thinking about pollution really recently. If I was to put a date on it, I would say last May 2014, because the World Health Organization told us that Beijing isn't the most polluted city, New Delhi is. Now, suddenly for the last year, the government, the people have started a conversation about the pollution problems we are having. But actual implementation of changes or any new policies are basically absent. And when it comes to Diwali, since it's a Hindu festival, the religious aspect makes any government body or a judicial body hesitant to actually take action.
Yeah, becomes a real hot potato. Is there anything like an alternative to fireworks? I mean, it's hard to imagine asking people not to celebrate Diwali, but what can you do aside from fireworks to have fun?
So I haven't set off fireworks for the last 10 years, but what we do is we go out and we set out lamps, which is the most significant aspect of Diwali if you actually go back to the reason why it's celebrated. And they're really not that necessary. I mean, just letting everybody who can buy firecrackers indiscriminately set them off, I mean, it's going to harm your kids. There's no plus side, really.
I just heard 2 more concussions just then. I would wish you a good night, but I'm not sure you'll be able to get to sleep anytime soon. Reporter reporter Nimisha Jaiswal in New Delhi, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you, Marco.
Take the outlines of that Diwali story in India to the global level, and you've essentially got the climate crisis, a growing air pollution problem that should have been addressed years ago, and a belated search for solutions. 6 years ago, world leaders met in Copenhagen and hammered out what most observers agree was a fairly timid plan to tackle climate change. Those leaders will be meeting again in a few weeks in Paris, hoping to do better. They better do better, because the problem's only gotten worse over the last 6 years. I spoke earlier this week with a man who knows that about as well as anyone. He's John Holdren, and he's the top science advisor to President Obama.
We have learned a lot about climate science in the last 6 years. We already knew a lot at the time of Copenhagen, certainly enough to take the kinds of actions that were needed and appropriate. But we've learned a lot more, and it's increased our sense of urgency. We know now, for example, that all around the world we're experiencing torrential downpours in increased frequency and magnitude. We're seeing climate impact on the severity of drought in many parts of the world. Wildfires, which people had hardly thought about in 2009, are proving to be a big deal. And we now know that there is the possibility of as much as 2 meters of sea level rise in this century.
So what does all that mean as we go into Paris?
Well, you know, going into Paris, I'm quite optimistic. We now have 150 countries that have entered their commitments for emissions reductions. Those 150 countries account for the great bulk of the world's emissions. And the reason they've all come forward with those commitments is that around the world it is understood that we need to take action to reduce the amount of climate change we're going to have to cope with. And it's also a recognition that we need to cooperate on building preparedness and resilience to deal with the changes in climate that can no longer be avoided.
So President Obama helped hammer out the Copenhagen deal 6 years ago. It calls for nations to make enough emissions cuts and other actions to hold the rise in global temperatures to 2 degrees Celsius. That's slightly shy of 4 degrees Fahrenheit. And it's thought that that would avoid truly dangerous catastrophic effects of climate change. So how close do those current pledges, as we go into Paris, get us to those goals?
Well, first of all, I would emphasize there is a difference between dangerous and catastrophic. I believe, and I think most climate scientists believe, we are already experiencing dangerous. So the question is, can we avoid truly catastrophic degrees of climate change? The commitments that have been made so far are not sufficient, but they are a big step in the right direction. And so an aim of the Paris conference is to come up with a framework that embeds the likelihood of additional ambition over time.
Yeah, but will they meet it?
I think they will meet it. Not only is the motivation for meeting it growing all the time, but the capability for meeting it is growing all the time. And so as time goes on and as our technologies get even better, countries are going to be able to be more ambitious because they're going to understand they can actually do it.
So let me get back to the goal again. Is 2 degrees the wrong target?
2 degrees was agreed by most of the world's nations, not because it's safe, but because it is probably the most prudent target that is still achievable. We are already at about 0.9 experiencing serious impacts of climate change. So we don't think 2 degrees C is safe. Mm. We just think it is more prudent than a higher number, and we can probably get to 2. If somebody can show us a way we can get to 1.5, I'll be all for it.
Climate change is a subject that's kind of a slow-motion disaster in the making, and I guess that even though the Obama administration is really focused on it, you and climate change go to the back of the Oval Office line when things like ISIS are happening or Eastern Ukraine is happening.
Well, I don't agree with your premise. We don't go to the back of the line. This president is very good at focusing on more than one issue at a time. He has lots of time and energy for focusing on climate change. So I'm energized. I think I have an enormous privilege in being able to work with the most science-savvy president since Thomas Jefferson. And I would note that there's a lot more science to be savvy about today than there was in Thomas Jefferson's time.
So when you think about those temperature numbers and you see these animated models of Florida and the Gulf Coast and 50 years of temperature rise continues, do you ever worry that right now you may not have done enough?
Of course. I worry, and I know the president worries, that we haven't done enough. We are doing everything we can right now using executive authorities, things that we can get done without requiring an act of Congress. But we could get more done if we had the Congress with us. And I very much look forward to the day when Congress comes on board and works with the executive branch to do more to address this challenge.
John Holdren is the head of President Obama's Office of Science and Technology Policy. Thank you very much for coming in.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
One way to measure our response to the challenges of climate change is by looking at transit maps. Seriously, they've evolved a lot over the past decade as our use of light rail and subways has increased. That's good news, environmentally speaking. That's according to Mark Ovenden. His 2003 book, Transit Maps of the World, was just updated this year.
Well, the great news is that since we first put the original book together, there are so many more metro, light rail, streetcar, subway systems around the world that we just had to do a new version of it. And I've really pleased to say that every single map within the original book has been replaced by a new contemporary map, and even the examples of those vintage historic maps looking back in time, all of those are fresh as well.
So this is a reflection of an overall increase in entire transit systems, not to mention new lines added onto old metros and transit systems?
Exactly. I mean, if you think about something like China, when we were writing the book in the beginning of the early 2000s, there was only a handful of metro systems there. Well, now there's something like 18, and by 2020 there's going to be 37 metro systems just in China. Almost every city is going to have its own urban rail system. Even the Americas now has 20 full metros and 33 light rail systems. So, I mean, around the world, people are beginning to realise the benefits of building a brand new transit system or extending the one they already had.
So in terms of green transportation, this sounds like a good thing. What do the experts that you've spoken with as you were putting this book together tell you?
Well, obviously, anyone using public transport and not using their car is contributing to less pollution and helping save the planet. Good transit map design gets people to use a system to recognize that it's a great system and it's easy to use. If you're looking at a simple transit map and you think, oh, I can go from A to B without taking my car, that hopefully is better for the environment.
Your presentation is pretty darn exhaustive. What are the cities that kind of surprise you that now have subways?
A lot of people are still quite surprised that LA has a subway. And I remember going on the Red Line when they first opened it in the 90s, and it's just fantastic that LA, which is the city everyone thought was dominated by the car, is really doing great efforts to invest in more public transport. So that's kind of one of my favourite ones in the US. Mm. And there are places like Izmir in Turkey. They've got like a full metro system there now. You've got the Gold Coast in Australia goes in the book for the first time. There's just all over the world, there's new exciting developments. And some of the maps are very beautiful as well.
Yeah, so talk about that a bit. Is there ever kind of a impulse to ride a subway when that subway has a beautiful map?
I think it plays a part. It's having that confidence that you're going to be able to get on a reliable, fast, frequent system, and you're going to be able to get from where you start to where you want to go easily. The Tokyo Metro, you know, it's a very, very complicated, dense system. But the map does actually help. And they've got this new system now in a lot of Southeast Asian countries, where they don't just number the stations, they also letter the lines. So you can literally go from station A22 to C41 and change at D15, and you're there. And that makes life a lot easier, especially when you've got a really big system.
What city created the template for the kind of common maps that we see now for subways around the world, the kind of almost electronic schematic? Was it London?
There was originally the belief that London was the creator of that particular style of mapping. But, you know, there's been a bit of research since that was first put forward, and it does look as if there might have been a very early geometric design for the Berlin S-Bahn a couple of years before Harry Beck did his famous London Tube map. But certainly the colour-coded lines, the expanding of the central area, the ability to give enough space to write the text name of the station as well as see where the station is, very clear interchange symbols. Those kind of ideas, which are kind of now standard metro or transit map looks, certainly originated probably from Harry Beck's original ideas. And I love the way that this iconography is being taken up by other people now. So you get maps of the human body and all the arteries done like a subway map. You get things like the solar system shown in a kind of subway map standard. So those ideas, the iconography of subway maps is definitely coming out from the world of transit.
You know, Mark, who uses these maps anymore? Because, like, when I go to New York City now, I pop up an app that tells me exactly what trains I need to transfer to and the shortest direction to get to my destination.
Oh, good question. And there is a lot of concern that these beautiful schematics represented in the book may not necessarily last because everyone uses little apps like that that perhaps rely on Google Maps or Bing or one of the other online maps and that literally tell you to turn left or right on this street and don't show you the network map. But I still think that there's a place for them, and some metro operators could probably do with putting them back on the front page of their websites because they're kind of sometimes a bit difficult to find. So I think we're always going to need a network map, but more and more people are going to integrate them with digital devices, yeah.
Well, Mark, thanks very much for curating these historic maps and for reminding us of, frankly, their beauty. Mark Ovenden, the author of Transit Maps of the World, thanks so much.
Enjoy the journey.
The Independence Showdown between Madrid and Barcelona, that's coming up here on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman with The World. Sometimes you need the highest court in the land to sort out the really big problems. Think back to 2000, for example, when the U.S. Supreme Court had to decide between Bush and Gore. They're having a similar moment in Spain, except it's not about who should lead the country, but whether the country should remain united exactly as it is right now, or for the northeastern region of the country, Catalonia, on the border with France, to go its own independent way. Spain's national government in Madrid wants the country's constitutional court to block the Catalonia drive for independence. It's kind of a complicated story, and Joseph Wilson is going to help us out with it. He's a reporter in Barcelona, has been covering the Catalan independence movement for the last few years. Help us with an analogy here, Joseph. Would this be like California or Texas trying to secede from the U.S.?
Yeah, it would be the same situation of a state in the United States wanting to break away. Actually, the example of California might be better in the sense of what it would mean to Spain, because Catalonia represents about one-fifth of the economy of Spain. That's something that the Spanish government is incredibly concerned about.
We'll get into what the consequences may be if secession does happen for Catalonia. But what exactly is the Spanish government in Madrid asking its constitutional court to do regarding all of this right now?
Well, they have asked the constitutional court to suspend a resolution that the regional parliament of Catalonia, which is in Barcelona, passed on Monday to set the region on an 18-month course to breaking away from Spain and establishing a Catalan Republic. And according to the Spanish government, that breaks the constitution. So they've asked them to halt that and to declare it unconstitutional.
What are attitudes like on the ground in Catalonia about secession? Like the pro-independence politicians there, do they actually represent what the people want?
The pro-separatist sentiment has definitely grown substantially in the past few years. And opinion polls consistently show that around 50% of Catalans now would like to break away, while another 50%, roughly, want to remain as a part of Spain.
I mean, if Catalonia wants to secede unilaterally, it seems that the pro-independence politician is going to have to do a much better job convincing the public that they ought to do it. 50% doesn't sound like it's going to kind of make the day.
That is definitely an argument that the politicians who are against independence use. In the regional elections that were held in September, the pro-independence parties won 48% of the real vote. And they had said that those elections should be used as a stand-in referendum on independence that the Spanish government, the Spanish courts, didn't allow them to hold last year. And so the anti-independence parties are using that argument, exactly as you've put it, to say there's not a significant majority of Catalans who want independence.
How big a deal would it be if Catalonia seceded from Spain?
It's impossible to speculate what the consequences would be, but they would be huge and enormous. Not only for Spain, but also the European Union. Various European leaders have said that if a region breaks away, then they would be out of the European Union. So it also, there would be a chunk of a wealthy and highly industrialized part of the Mediterranean that would be outside the European Union.
Do you think it would prompt a kind of copycat secession from other regions in Spain?
That's definitely one of the fears that the Spanish government surely has.
Could you imagine a day with an independent Catalonia? And can you imagine what that world would actually look like?
That's difficult to tell. If you talk to people here, say 5-10 years ago, I think very few people would imagine they would ever see an independent Catalonia. But you could say there are a lot more people who believe that it is a real possibility now.
Reporter Joseph Wilson in Barcelona, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
This final story is about changing old attitudes. In Kenya, gay sex is punishable by up to 14 years in prison. And the people in the LGBT community there regularly talk about attacks, kidnappings, extortion, and police harassment. But some Kenyans are trying to shift mindsets, and one of them is a cartoonist. The World's Carol Hills has more.
Imagine you're a political cartoonist for your country's largest newspaper, but one of the topics you cartoon about, in this case, gay rights for Kenyans, really angers your readers.
Most people in the country, they're quite homophobic, actually. And I think one of the roles of a cartoonist is to challenge society, not just mirror it, challenge some of these attitudes.
Cartoonist Patrick Gathara gets angry emails and letters whenever he touches on the issue of gay rights in Kenya. Some typical comments: homosexuality is an import. It's part of a Western agenda. It's un-African.
I've made the point that homosexuality is not un-African. You know, it is very much part of Africa. Throughout the ages, there were homosexual people within Africa. We are not an exception to the world.
What really exasperates Gathara about the un-African argument is that it plays into the notion of the noble savage, the colonial-era idea of an African who hasn't been corrupted by civilization. For Gathara, it's the noble savage that's un-African. Yet many Kenyans who were vehemently anti-gay seem to have bought into it. In 2009, Gathara drew a cartoon to note the one-year anniversary of a power-sharing agreement between then-President Mwai Kibaki and Prime Minister Raila Odinga. Gay marriage had been in the news in Kenya.
Two gay Kenyans had gotten married in London, and it made a lot of news back home. A lot of people came out sort of condemning them, saying this is painting Kenyans in a bad light, shouldn't be happening, Kenyans are not gay, all that rubbish. And what I did was turn it on its head.
In the cartoon, Gathara drew Odinga and Kibaki as two men getting married. The caption read, "Actually, gay marriage is not new in Kenya. We've had it for at least a year." His newspapers refused to publish it, but Gathara snuck it into a later exhibit of his work. For the record, lots of Gathara's cartoons are spiked. Cartoons about religious leaders, anything about Islam. And Gathara says he isn't just trying to push his countrymen's buttons. And he doesn't have a personal agenda. Gathara's married to a woman. He has two kids. He genuinely wants to try to change Kenyans' attitudes.
I think that I'm pushing other people to actually stand up and say that we need to protect every Kenyan. You know, every African, irrespective of what their affiliations are, what their sexual orientation is, you know, it shouldn't really matter when it comes to simply saying everybody should have equal rights.
This past summer, a social media frenzy ensued in the weeks leading up to President Obama's visit. The hashtag Kenyan's message to Obama was trending. Typical tweets, "Don't lecture us on gay marriage," and "That gay vibe should remain in America." A few Kenyan cartoonists warned Obama not to impose a Western agenda on Kenya. President Uhuru Kenyatta weighed in, saying gay rights was a non-issue. Gathara responded with a cartoon portraying Kenyatta standing on top of gay people. The point, gay rights isn't a non-issue if you're a gay Kenyan.
I did get lots of people sort of saying you shouldn't be talking about this, you know, you should ignore it, we should all be celebrating Obama. And I think it very much shows how our society is really unwilling to tackle this issue. I think cartoonists need to do quite a lot more, and journalists, to actually challenge these attitudes and to get laws put in place to protect the rights of gay people.
Gathara doesn't think of himself as especially courageous. He's ashamed he hasn't done more about gay rights. But one of the things he has planned is an exhibit of LGBT cartoons in Nairobi. For The World, I'm Carol Hills.
Carol will be in the host chair for a couple of days starting tomorrow. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for being here.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org, by the Skoll Foundation, supporting innovative solutions to the world's most pressing problems with the Skoll Award for Social Entrepreneurship. More information is available at skoll.org. The PRI Ambassador Council, including Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Gruber Family Foundation, Marguerite Steed Hoffman, and the Robbins Kaplan Miller Cerisi Foundation, and the Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and strengthening international peace and security at carnegie.org, and by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, gatesfoundation.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.